Greet everyone this morning in the name of Jesus. Good to be sharing with or to be in this service this morning. The theme of God's greatness, the establishment of the church, and then the universe as we heard in the devotional. And then I hear that we have a theme this evening about the fool saying in their heart that there is no God. So I'm hoping, trusting the message I share this morning won't steal somebody's thunder too badly this evening. But if not, if it does, then it won't hurt us to hear it again. I'd like to continue on in the book of Isaiah. Isaiah chapter 40 mostly, and we'll go into 41 a little later if we have time. Isaiah 40 is worth stopping and considering, and many blessings here. This chapter 40 of Isaiah is, if we were to just leave out verse 30 or chapter 36 to 39, and consider that to be not an insertion, but maybe an inclusion. God used 36 to 39, the story of the deliverance from the Assyrian army, as an example of what he can do with his people when they look to him and his power that he can display. There was no human reason for the defeat of the Assyrian army. The Jewish army, the Jewish city, was in a hopeless condition. They were vastly outnumbered, and yet God delivered them. And so that's inserted there. And already we see back in the prior chapters up to 34, there was a lot of woes pronounced on the nations. And then chapter 35 begins as a chapter of promise to the children of Israel. And then the theme continues here in chapter 40. And I would say that this one is somewhat of a crowning jewel of the book of Isaiah, not to minimize other parts of the book, but we know verses from this chapter, we refer to it, and the closing verses of this chapter is a motto verse, one of those verses that we know, they that wait upon the Lord shall renew their strength, and we enjoy, and rightfully so, that verse, because it gives us hope and promise in times of difficulty. I'd like to read the chapter at this time, but then when we get to verse 29 to 31, I'd ask the congregation to join in with me in reading that. So we'll read the chapter this time. Comfort ye, my people, saith your God. Speak ye comfortably to Jerusalem, and cry unto her, that her warfare is accomplished, that her iniquity is pardoned, for she hath received of the Lord's hand double for all her sins. The voice of him that crieth in the wilderness, prepare ye the way of the Lord, make straight in the desert a highway for our God. Every valley shall be exalted, and every mountain and hill shall be made low, and the crooked places made straight, and the rough places plain, and the glory of the Lord shall be revealed, and all flesh shall see it together, for the mouth of the Lord has spoken it. The voice said, cry. And he said, what shall I cry? All flesh is grass, and all the goodliness thereof is as the flower of the field. The grass withereth, the flower fadeth, because the Spirit of the Lord bloweth upon it. Surely the people is grass. The grass withereth, the flower fadeth, but the word of our God shall stand forever. O Zion, that bringest good tidings, get thee up into the mountain. O Jerusalem, that bringest good tidings, lift up thy voice with strength. Lift it up, be not afraid. Say unto the cities of Judah, behold your God. Behold, the Lord will come with strong hand, and his arm shall rule for him. Behold, his reward is with him, and his work before him. He shall feed his flock like a shepherd. He shall gather the lambs with his arm and carry them in his bosom, and he shall gently lead those that are with young. Who hath measured the waters in the hollow of his hand and meted out the heaven with a span and comprehended the dust of the earth in a measure and weighed the mountains in scales and the hills in a balance? Who hath directed the Spirit of the Lord, or being his counselor, hath taught him? With whom took he counsel, and who instructed him, and taught him in the path of judgment, and taught him knowledge, and showed it to him the way of understanding? Behold, the nations are as a drop of a bucket, and are counted as small dust of the balance. Behold, he taketh up the isles as a very little thing. And Lebanon is not sufficient to burn, nor the beasts thereof sufficient for a burnt offering. All nations before him are as nothing, and they are counted to him less than nothing and vanity. To whom will ye liken God? Or what likeness shall you compare unto him? The workman melteth a graven image, and the goldsmith spreadeth it over with gold, and casteth silver chains. He that is so impoverished that he hath no oblation chooseth a tree that will not rot. He seeketh unto him a cunning workman to prepare a graven image that shall not be moved. Have you not known? Have you not heard? Hath it not been told you from the beginning? Have you not understood from the foundations of the earth? It is he that sitteth upon the circle of the earth, and the inhabitants thereof are as grasshoppers, and stretcheth out the heavens as a curtain, and spreadeth them out as a tent to dwell in. That bringeth the princes to nothing, he maketh the judges of the earth as vanity. Yea, they shall not be planted, yea, they shall not be sown, yea, their stock shall not take root in the earth. And he shall also blow upon them, and they shall wither, and the whirlwind shall take them away as stubble. To whom then will ye liken me, or shall I be equal, saith the Holy One? Lift up your eyes on high. Behold, who hath created these things, that bringeth out their hosts by number. He calleth them all by names, by the greatness of his might, for that he is strong in power, not one faileth. Why sayest thou, O Jacob, and speakest thou, O Israel, my way is hid from the Lord, and my judgment is passed over from my God? Hast thou not known? Hast thou not heard that the everlasting God, the Lord, the Creator of the ends of the earth, fainteth not, neither is weary? There is no searching of his understanding. Join in. He giveth power to the faint, and to them that have no might he increaseth strength. Even the youth shall faint and be weary, and the young men shall utterly fail. But they that wait upon the Lord shall renew their strength. They shall mount up with wings as eagles. They shall run and not be weary. They shall walk and not faint. Wonderful promise. Going back to verse 1, the verse is calling, it's a comfort call. In fact, the next 8 chapters 40 to 48 are considered by some commentators to be the comfort chapters of the book of Isaiah. And here God is wishing that his people would understand this. He was wishing that he would hear their call, his offer, his offer of comfort. And he says, speak comfortably, Jerusalem, and cry unto her, that her warfare is accomplished, that her iniquity is pardoned. For she hath received of the Lord double for all her sins. That's an interesting statement, I think. I do not know to what extent, how the punishment of Jerusalem would compare to the punishment of, and Israel for that matter, to the punishment of other Gentile nations, which inevitably happened from time to time. But it does say here that the people of God suffered tremendously and suffered doubly, it says. I'm thinking of the idea that as the people of God, they were privileged. To them were given the oracles of God, as it says elsewhere. They were responsible. And maybe their actual punishment was not as bad as some nations have had received. But because they fell so far, it was like a double punishment. Because they had the opportunity to know God and to do his will, and they fell so far that it was a double punishment. And maybe God, I think, is a lot like good, kind, loving parents are today when they punish their children. It's something that they don't delight doing. It's painful. They do it because they know it's their obligation. They know that they have an end result for their child that they want, and they have an obligation to God. But it's painful to do it. And so it feels like they're almost receiving double for what they have done. At least after a while it might feel that way. And we hear the child's cry, we see the suffering that they may undergo, but then we want to call them to peace and to comfort. We want the relationship restored. And I trust that there's parents that know what that's like. I'm sure there is, where you have had to do the hard things for your child. And then there's a restoration. There's peace. There's tranquility brought to that relationship. And I think that's the spirit that God, in that spirit, God was calling to his people. He was longing for that rest and that restored relationship. Then it talks about the voice of him that crieth in the wilderness. And we rightly and automatically connect that to over to Matthew 3:3 and possibly some other references. This is where John the Baptist, it's used in that context, and John the Baptist seems to be the primary fulfillment of this voice. Prepare the way, the way of the Lord, make straight in the desert a highway for our God. And I suppose we won't understand this side of eternity, the work of John the Baptist and what he did for the ministry of Jesus. But it does seem that the scriptures make it very significant. It's talking about valleys being exalted. This is road building in verse 4. The valleys be lifted up. You build a good highway, you raise it up in the valley, so and the mountains and the hills shall be made low. You level things out, and a well-built road is just that way. So there's less hill, there's less dips and dives. And John the Baptist, as a messenger of God, did that, prepared the hearts of the people so that the message of the gospel could flow, not in a dipsy and a divey and a turbulent way, but in a smooth way to our hearts, to their hearts. And we long for that message. We see the ultimate result in verse 5 of the work of the John the Baptist. The glory of the Lord shall be revealed, and all flesh shall see it together. So we see here already with the nation of Israel, while there is further restoration promised, the glory of the Lord, the work of Jesus Christ, is going to be the cornerstone of the restoration for the nation of Israel, yea, for the whole world. Without the work of Jesus Christ, there will be no restoration. There's no glory to be revealed. And God is promising that was to be revealed. And we know that we are still witnessing the revelation. We're still benefiting from the revelation of Jesus Christ. I believe there's an ongoing fulfillment of prophecy. Then verse 6 says, there's a call. The voice said, cry. And that would be the idea of not a sad cry, a weeping cry, but a cry out, a calling. Pay attention. Make a notice. And we need that reminder of the message that is about to be given here. The prophet says, what shall I cry? And then it's a simple message. All flesh is as grass, and all goodliness thereof is as the flower of the field. And goes on to talk about how if the Spirit of God blows upon the work of the grass, be it a tall grass, a small grass, when it blows upon that, it ends. It has a life cycle. And so we may think this morning, We may think of, we're going to be talking about the nations down in the following verse here, but the mighty nations of the world. We may think of the magnificent towers and structures that are in some of the cities across the face of the earth. We may think of powerful men today that seem to have an ironclad grip of power on their nation, and nothing seems to be able to change that. But it's as grass. It will come to an end. The Spirit of the Lord will blow upon it, and it'll be gone. It'll be over. And it's just the way it is. The grass that is so green, and if it's like the grass that's at our place that needs a trimming real shortly again, it seems so lush, and what could bring it to an end? But the Spirit of God is there. It blows on it, and it's done. And so I think the lesson for us to always remember in all of this, and we know this, but it's good for us to be reminded time and time again. And this is why, as God's people, it's good as a church that we pay attention to death. And I want to say we were blessed with the amount of young people that were involved in the past funeral here. You know, I know what it's like to be like that, and I didn't always find it so exciting either as a young person to get involved in these kind of things. But it's good to do that. It's good to consider that, yes, I might be 17 or 15 or 18 or 25 or 30, and seems like life is stretching out before me. And that's all right. But do remember that it can end so quickly, and all flesh, whether it's untimely or whether it's to 70, 80, 90, or even 100 years, it'll be over so quickly and so soon. All flesh. But then there's a message of hope in verse 9 given here. And it says, O Zion that bringest good tidings, get thee up into the mountains. O Jerusalem that bringest good tidings, lift up thy voice with strength. Lift it up, be not afraid, and say unto the cities of Judah. We'll stop there for a bit, then we'll look at the message. So consider this. At this time, I'm not sure when this passage was written, but if it was close to the prior passages of the time of Hezekiah, then these were difficult times. And the Assyrian army was advancing and making gains on the smaller cities and the towns around Jerusalem. And it looked like Jerusalem was going to be the next victim. But the call here is for Zion and Jerusalem as the city up on the mountain on the hill. You send out a message of hope. You tell them, lift up your voice and say, behold your God. This is not a time to despair, but this is a time that the city of Zion and Jerusalem was to call out in hope, even despite the advancement of the enemy armies. And I think that's a beautiful picture here of our calling here today as the Church of Jesus Christ. We are called. We see distresses. We see troubles. We see threats. But we're not to succumb to that. We're not to give up in despair. We're not to throw in the towel, so to speak. But rather, we call out with an important message, a very important message. One of the key thoughts here in this chapter, behold your God. And I need that reminder. You know, we get muddled in life, in the busyness of it, and the troubles of life, and the things that happen, and the schedules, and all of that stuff. And it's real. We need to deal with it. But, you know, if we can consider what the message is here, behold your God. What does it say in verse 10? The Lord will come with strong hand, and his arm shall rule for him. Behold his reward and his work before him. God has a mission. God has a purpose. God has something that he is going to accomplish in the world, with the church, and with you, if you are faithful to him. Behold your God. He is strong. He is mighty. And he can rise up and he can deal judgment to the enemies of God. He can strengthen us. And we enjoy that thought. There is power. And yet, in all of that, notice it's contrasting, but this is all in the concept of behold your God. See in verse 11. He shall feed his flock like a shepherd, lead it. And I've never been a stock man very much, but anything that I've heard and understood that maybe this doesn't apply if you have huge amounts of cattle or sheep or whatever, but the shepherd here that may have had, let's say, 20, 30 sheep, they knew each other, and he led them and cared about them and watched his sheep and observed if there was sickness or illness and led them, as it says in Psalm 23, to green pastures. And there was a camaraderie built between them. They knew each other. And that's how it says that God will lead his flock like a shepherd. That's a beautiful picture there. Then it goes on to say, and he shall gather the lambs with his arm and carry them in his bosom. He's a gentle shepherd, and he will gather and carry the young. Young Christians, young believers, young people, young children. And you know, maybe I'd like to speak specifically to young people this morning. You're facing the realities of life, and there's difficult things that you already have experienced and had to face and make decisions. And maybe some not so pleasant things have happened to you already in your life. But just think about this shepherd. He says he's going to gently carry them in his bosom. God cares about the weak and the vulnerable, and goes on to talk about those that need special consideration. Gently lead those that are with young. And I simply say this, behold your God. This is the God that we serve. He is the mighty God of the universe. And we're going to see more of that as we go through the chapter here yet. He made it. He controls it. He directs it. He's the leader of his people. He's the revenger of evil. He directs his people with strength, but he leads them gently. And he cares about every one of his sheep, every one of you this morning that have named the name of Christ. This is the promise that he has for us. Behold your God. Who else could be like that? Who else could be that great, that magnificent, and yet so gentle? This is the God that we serve. And then it talks about here in verse 12 here, the self-sufficiency of God. He did the work by himself. And verse 13, you know, the Lord did not hire a team of consultants or architects or whatever it may have been to build this world. He didn't build a council and say, how should we do this? Who directed? Or being his counselor hath taught him, with whom took he counsel? He did it his own. And he, consider this, maybe it's not profound, and yet I think it is. You know, God's existence, we think about God and we automatically think about the connection to the world, to us, and think that they're totally entwined. And there is a lot. We see that. But were this whole universe to perish, everything, people, the world itself, the universe, the stars and the moon, and all the galaxies and everything were to disappear overnight, it wouldn't change God's existence one iota. He'd still be God. He'd still be self-sufficient. He'd still be who he is. And that's the God that we have. And I think, you know, we need to keep these things in focus, because sometimes we get a little bit like maybe our society propels us to this kind of thinking. We have our rights. We have those things that we deserve. And in some senses, that is true in a way. And yet, really, when we think of the self-existence of God and who he is and how he needs nothing, he desires our praise, he desires adoration, but he needs absolutely nothing from us. And yet he pays us all this attention. Behold your God. This is the God that we serve. He is totally sufficient. And then for 15 and 17, it talks about the smallness of the nations. You know, and we're in a time in the world today where there's a lot of shift. Yes, there's some mighty powers. There's the United States, which in a lot of is quite arguably still the most powerful nation on the face of the earth, seems to be weakening. There's other powers that are nipping at its heels. There's other nations that have wealth. They have whatever they have, resources. Canada doesn't have much of military strength or maybe economic, but we have a lot of resources. Canada is viewed as one of the envies of the world because of that. And of course, it's nothing that the Canadians have done. It's simply that which has been in their land, and they have been granted that. But despite all of that, God uses nations. God uses people. But they are nothing to him. He can flatten and defeat an empire very quickly. A powerful nation can be destroyed. A powerful nation can be brought to heel by a smaller nation, if God so deigns. God controls all of that. And so we do not have to be disturbed by that. Now, I realize that sometimes people in difficult situations think of the Christians in particular China, because it is a powerful country and it is controlling. And it would be tempting for those Christians to think, well, when is this going to end? Will God ever bring this to an end, this persecution that we're under? But God is mighty, and he is greater, and he is more powerful than all that military might and the system of that government. He is greater than all of that. Then it talks about verse 18 to 22, the natural, you know, and I'm not a psychologist and don't tend to be one, but notice how the tendency of humanity of witnessing the greatness of God and witnessing the universe, witnessing the power of nature, and almost invariably, not every society, not every race of people have done this, but many have done what we see in verse 21, or verse 19. The question is raised, how do you liken God? You know, we like to see things. We like to have the tangible. This is something I can put my finger on. This is something I can understand. And so the tendency has been to create images that we can understand. And so the workman melteth a graven image. The goldsmith spreadeth it over with the gold and casteth the silver chains. And now the one that doesn't have money for gold and silver, he goes and finds a tree that is pretty good wood, won't rot, and finds a cunning craft workman to prepare a graven image. And they're all supposed to be images of the same God. And they worship that object. Now, we know that even in idolatry today, there's more to it than just that. Because when man gives their allegiance to an object, to a material thing, They're giving their heart to something. And behind that idolatry, unquestionably, is another god, an evil god, the devil himself. And we need to think about that when we give our allegiance to something different than God. That when we turn our hearts and our minds, we're giving our minds, our souls, to a power other than God. And that power will control us in one way or another because we're not recognizing God for who he is. And so let's not, God is real. And God touches our hearts. But we do not need to quantify God to an image. We do not need to try to contain God. That's not for us. The wonder of God's people is that they can leave God be who he is. And he is the great God of the universe. He is the being that is that has no physical description, at least on the earth here, but rather other than in the form of Jesus Christ, he came as a man. But we leave God, we let God be who he is. And so we don't have to bring him down to that level. We rather worship him for who he is. What a wonderful blessing that we have there. It goes on to say in verse 22, it's he that sitteth upon the circle of the earth. And I understand that word upon has more the idea of sits above the circle of the earth. Inhabitants thereof are as a grasshopper. Now, some people use this to refute the idea of the flat earth theory. And it probably has a bit of strength that way. But I suppose the flat earthers can still believe in a circle too. Regardless of what that is, we'll leave that discussion and that foolish discussion out of the picture here. But God, it is interesting in this context that the word circle is used. It introduces the idea of the universe and how it may and how it is formed. We know that. It's he that sits above it. And God directs things. He will judge the nations in verse 23 and 24. Notice that 25, 26. Again, the question is raised. And this question comes up repeatedly. To what will you liken God? And it doesn't really give us any description, any picture. This is how God is. This is what he looks like. But rather, in this chapter here, and as in the Bible, when it talks about God, it tells us what God does, what he is, and where he is, and what he will do for us, and what he has created. Verse 26, lift up your eyes on high. And if you have the privilege to get away from our light-polluted area of the universe, get somewhere where it's just a little darker at night than around here, the beauty of this expanse is even more dramatic, and it is wonderful. And notice what it says here. He has created these things, bringeth out their host by number. He calleth them all by names, by the greatness of his might. Calleth them all by names. I don't know how many stars are there. Millions? For sure millions. Maybe in billions. Where's the astronomers? Think so, Aiden? Yes. So billions isn't a stretch at all. So maybe we can go up to trillions if we want to. And we still might not cover it. He calls them all by name. Can you imagine that? We can't. That's the majesty of our God. And what else it says here is that none goes missing. None disappear. Of the trillions, I think, based on what we heard now, trillions is right. None disappears. Behold your God. He's mighty in power. And then it's a very valid question is raised. And this meets our thinking too many times. Verse 27, why sayest thou, O Jacob, and speakest, O Israel, my way is hid from the Lord, and my judgment is passed over from God, my God. This is not so much talking about one who is trying to hide his life from God or sin. It might include it. But rather, it's more the idea that we may be tempted to feel at times is, where is God? Or God doesn't see me. God isn't paying attention to me. I'm insignificant to his cause and to us as a people, to us individually. Well, let's think of it this way. If he knows the names of trillions of stars, and that's way more than the population of the earth, stars, big objects, big balls of fire, and why would he not know you? Why would he not know you and know you by name? Well, the Bible says we know also elsewhere that he knows the very hairs of the number of our head. God has not forgotten us. And then we're reminded that of that in verse 28, that the everlasting, and like this, the everlasting God, the Lord, the creator of the ends of the earth, fainteth not, neither is weary. There's no searching of his understanding. God doesn't even come close to getting tired. There's no weariness. His power is infinitesimal. It just goes on and on and on. There's nothing that stops him. And that's a wonderful truth of all of its own. But God is not selfish with his power. God doesn't retain all his power to himself. And if there's such a wonderful resource of power out there, we don't need much of God's power to help us along a little bit, do we? Just a little bit of God's power is very helpful. And God is ready to do that for us. These wonderful verses, he gives power to the faint, to the weak. And to them that have no might, he increases strength. Elsewhere in the scripture would indicate this, but it's true here. God does want us to do our part. That's true. We are responsible. But when we feel that we can do it in our strength and it is within our resources, we're able to do it all by ourselves, God doesn't need to help us. And he probably, I was going to say probably won't. He may help us a little bit. But God delights when humanity is weak and they recognize it and they call to God and say, I need your help. I need your strength. I'm done. I'm at the limit of my resources. Maybe there's some things that we can do to adjust so we don't get there so often. Maybe there isn't. Sometimes life comes upon us very strong and very heavily. This is the promise that God's people have. Even in extremity, it says, even the youth shall faint and be weary, and the young men shall utterly fail. But they that wait upon the Lord shall renew their strength. I looked up that word wait, and I didn't find a strong meaning, but interestingly enough, almost every time where that was used in the Hebrew in the Old Testament, it has a connection to God. So there is something about that waiting, which means of, it speaks of patience, speaks of reliance, speaks of trust. We wait, we commit, we hand it over to God, and then we say, Lord, it's in your hands. And notice the promise here. They shall mount up with wings as eagles. They shall run and not be weary, and they shall walk and not faint. A little bit of God's power. Just a little bit of God's power. And that's the promise to us. Just a little diversion to this thought. I recall hearing some years ago that during the the return of Jewish people to the Palestine. I'm not sure if it would have been before, probably after the nation of Israel was established. I'm not trying to make a prophetic point with this. I'm just pointing this out of interest. There was a group of Jewish people picked up, I'm not sure which country. They lived in very primitive circumstances, and the Israeli government took planes down there to pick these folks up. And as they boarded the plane and flew, this is the verse that came to their mind. They shall mount up with wings as eagles. Well, that was fine on their part there. But we as God's people, we can claim this and believe and know that we can rise above the circumstances of life. And I realize I'm talking about lofty and grand concepts here. And sometimes it takes a lot of fighting and a lot of faith and a lot of, well, maybe not fighting, faith and believing that this is how it can be. But this is what God promises. And furthermore, in chapter 41, just real briefly, it talks about not fearing in verse 10. Fear not. This is in reference to the servant of Israel. Fear not, I am with thee. Be not dismayed. I am thy God. I will strengthen thee. Yea, I will help thee. Yea, I will uphold thee with the right hand of my righteousness. Behold, all they that were incensed against thee shall be ashamed and confounded. And they shall not be as shall be as nothing. They that strive with thee shall perish. Thou shalt seek them and shall not find them. Even them that contend with thee, they that war against thee shall be as nothing and as a thing of naught. For I, the Lord, thy God, will hold thy right hand, saying unto thee, fear not, I will help thee. Fear not, thou worm Jacob and ye men of Israel. I will help thee, saith the Lord God, and thy Redeemer and the Holy One of Israel. Fear not, I will help thee. I will renew your strength. May we go forth this week. I don't know what your situation is, but these are the promises of God to old and young, that God is there to help us, and may we claim them and move forward in faith. We'll have a closing number in song.